We hope this message from Word of Life Church is a blessing to you.
So this morning, I'm going to conclude our series, The Ancient and Mysterious Stories of God, by telling you one final story from the Old Testament. This series of seven stories have all been taken from the Old Testament, and Pastor Brian will be here Friday night. He'll be preaching in our Friday night service in the MYC, and then next Sunday morning, we'll be starting a new series telling stories from the New Testament during the season of Lent. But I'm closing out this series, so let me give you a little bit of a review. We started by telling the story of Abraham on three long walks, and then the story of Jacob, the son of laughter, how he wrestled with that angel. Then we have the story of Jonah, a comedy. We laughed as we saw God working through the comedic life of Jonah. Then the story of Esther, told the story of God and gallows, how God enters into our suffering. Then last week I told you the story of Rahab, a sinful woman. And now in the final installment of this series, I want to tell you the story of Gideon, an unknown man. And that'll be the title for the message this morning, Gideon, an unknown man. Now, to tell you Gideon's story, I need to back up just a little bit and talk again about Joshua. Joshua is the character that connects Rahab, the story I told last week, with Gideon, the story I tell you today. Joshua, if you will remember, was the right-hand man of Moses, helping Moses lead the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage. And Joshua became an assistant to Moses during that 40-year period between leaving Egypt and arriving to the Promised Land. For 40 years, they wandered in the wilderness. And Joshua became the assistant to Moses, being lifted up as a protege in front of all the people, so that when Moses dies, Joshua steps up and takes command. And so Joshua leads Israel to possess the land that God had given them, the land occupied by the Canaanites, the land of Cana, which is what we now know today as modern-day Israel. The Canaanites were the indigenous people. But God, being creator, owned that land, and God chose to give that land to his covenant people, the people of Israel. And so Joshua enters into that land. The first city is Jericho, and that's where Rahab lived, and Rahab hid the spies, so kindness was shown to Rahab and her family. And Rahab, through an act of kindness and a scarlet cord, is rescued, her and her whole family. And Rahab enters into the covenant community of the people of God. And Joshua continues his conquest of this promised land, the land promised to Abraham. And a part of the conquest was fighting, attacking, and winning the land and driving out the Canaanite people. And Joshua was fairly successful at doing so because Joshua was a good leader. Joshua was able to rally the troops. When Joshua would stand and speak, the people would listen. And Joshua was successful in leading Israel to the worship of the one true living God. Now, as the people of Israel lived in Egypt and then in the wilderness, now in the land of Cana, they were surrounded by pagan worship, idol worship, surrounded them wherever they went. And it was a constant temptation to choose to worship idols over choosing to worship the one true God. And Joshua was not just a cunning military leader, but he was a strong and savvy and charismatic spiritual leader, able to guide the entire nation of Israel to worship the one true living God. And as with all great leaders, Joshua had great speeches. He was known to stand before the people and offer these great speeches. And that's what great leaders do. Great leaders are known for their speeches, and great leaders are known by even their one-liners. And Joshua has one of those one-liners when he stands in front of the people and he asks them, choose this day who you will serve. And there's this great one line, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Maybe you've heard that before. Let me give it to you in context. Joshua speaking as recorded in Joshua 24 and verse 14, Joshua says to the people, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we shall serve the Lord." Now, Joshua's story prepares the way for the story of Gideon. But Joshua, this commanding and charismatic leader, in saying, "As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord," they just rallied the people. And they said, "Yes, we will say no to the gods of the pagan people. And we will say yes to the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the one true living God." Now, there were pagan temples and idol worship throughout the area, but specifically in the land of Cana, there were two popular gods. Now, most of the Semitic world was polytheistic. They worshiped many gods, but they had their favorites. I mean, if you have dozens and dozens of gods, it becomes a lot of work worshiping each of them. You got to pick your favorites. And so there were two in particular, and this is important for telling the story of Gideon, that you're aware. The two really popular, most popular gods worshipped in the land of Cana was Baal and Asherah. Baal was a sky god. He was worshipped as the god of thunder and storms. And Asherah was his goddess. And she was worshipped as the goddess of fertility and sexuality. And together they were worshipped all throughout this land that Joshua and the people of Israel were entering into. And so as they made their homes in this new promised land, they could see where these gods were worshipped, because spread throughout the land would have been an altar to Baal, and then a pole that was either wooden or stone in a feminine shape that was a place to worship Asherah, known as an Asherah pole. So it was very common for the Canaanite people to have this altar to Baal, this Asherah pole, and that was their focal point of worship. And this begins to play out in the story of Gideon. But during Joshua's reign, during his leadership, things went pretty good. It was so far so good. They were spreading out in the land. They were driving out the Canaanites. But they weren't able to drive them all out before the death of Joshua. But things were going good. Worship was staying square in front of Yahweh, the God of Israel. But then Joshua dies. And when he dies, well, things don't go so well. There's no assistant to Joshua who steps up to be that one single unifying leader. So the people begin to lose their sense of national identity, and they begin to find their identity within their own tribes. There were 12 different tribes of Israel. And after the death of Joshua, without a central leader, people begin to lose that sense of a nation, and they saw themselves within their own tribes. So they became a confederacy of tribes more than a nation. And worse than that, their love and devotion for God began to grow cold. Joshua was able to keep them focused, but the overwhelming temptation to bow to these altars of Baal and Asherah poles began to overtake many in the various tribes of Israel, and they began to worship idols. And Judges records for us what happens when Joshua and that generation dies. In Judges chapter 2 and verse 10, it says, "And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers." That's all of the Joshua generation. They died, gathered to their fathers, a euphemism for death. "And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel." With the death of Joshua began idol worship among the people. And then that whole generation that had fought and served and followed Joshua, when they died out, a new generation grew up in that land and they did not know the Lord. And this verse stands to tell one of the sadder parts in Jewish history, that they would go through this cycle of worshiping God, falling into disobedience and worshiping idols. And this sad story should serve as a reminder for those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ that we are only one generation away from losing the faith. And as a pastor and as a parent, I'm deeply concerned that we are not only passing on the faith and proclaiming the gospel to our generation, but we are also remembering the generation that's coming up and that we're passing our faith on to them. And this has really become the vision of our church, that we're going to become the kind of church that makes it easy for our children and grandchildren to grow up as followers of Jesus Christ. And so as a church, what we can do is to rally around parents, to love them and pray for them and support them, and rally around those that serve in our student ministry and children's ministry and give them our love and support. We need to pat them on the back. We need to take them out to lunch and buy their lunch. Both our staff and volunteers in our student ministries and our children's ministries, they need our support as a congregation, because they specifically are laboring in this mission field of this next generation. Because I don't want it said of us like it was said of Joshua's generation, that after we get old and die, which we will, that another generation grows up not knowing the Lord. But that's what happened when Joshua died. And so it wasn't good in Israel. Judges 2 goes on to tell you what it was like after this generation grew up not knowing the Lord. Judges chapter 2, verse 11, "And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went out after other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger." It wasn't good at all. Notice that their worship was connected to their lifestyle. When they began to worship idols is when they began to do evil in the sight of the Lord. Not just evil in the fact they were breaking the commandment and worshiping idols, but their lives became evil because our lifestyle is connected to our worship. We become like that we idolize, like we worship. So this generation after Joshua didn't know the Lord. They begin to worship idols. They did evil in the sight of the Lord, and it provoked the Lord to anger. When God saw his people, the people he had rescued, the people he promised a land to, forsake him, begin to worship idols, God began to experience anger. But the good news is that God tempers his judgment with mercy. And so in his mercy, in his great love, God says, "I'm going to send to you guys judges." And that's the name of the book of the Bible that tells the story of Gideon. "That I'm going to send to you these judges, and they are going to lead you in a right way." Now, the Judges is a book in the Bible. It's right after Joshua. And so if you want to find where the Gideon story is, it is in Judges, sixth book of the Bible. You can find that if you would like. The word judges, however, is problematic, because these judges in the history of Israel were not men and women with gray hair, wearing long black robes, sitting behind a bench with a gavel. Not one of those judges. A better English word would be to call them warlords, because that's indeed what they were. When God, in his anger, saw Israel beginning to worship idols, in his mercy, he says, "I will send you these warlords," or these judges. And they were indeed warlords, for they led armies into war, into battle, to drive out the Canaanites as God had instructed. And these warlords were also lords in the sense that they had leadership over the people of Israel. And they were called not just to win in battle, but to lead the people back to the worship of God. And Gideon becomes one of these warlords. Now, in Gideon's day, things were not looking good. In Gideon's day, Israel, they were living in the land of Cana, but they were finding themselves getting beat up day in and day out by the Midianites. Now, there were all sorts of groups living around in that area. The Canaanites were living in the land. Israel went in, began to drive them out. But there were other groups that were surrounding them. And one of those groups, one of those ethnic peoples, were the Midianites. The Midianites were a nomadic desert people. They were nomadic in the sense they didn't have a home. They existed by plundering the food and wealth and supplies and gold of other people. That's how they lived. The Midianites were known as some of the first people to use camels in battle. If you've been to our Christmas Eve service, you have seen a camel up close and personal. And camels were used in ancient times for transportation. And these Midianites learned how not just to use them to get from point A to point B, but to use them successfully in battle. And so the Midianites were attacking Israel to steal their stuff so that they could They were stealing the stuff of Israel so they could live. That's the word I'm looking for. And Israel was getting beat up day in and day out by the Midianites. God indeed had lifted his protection. And Midianites were crushing Israel. And so Gideon appears upon the scene. And where we first find Gideon is not a warrior in battle. Gideon is hiding out in a wine press, not making wine, but he was processing some wheat. He was doing that because he was hiding, because he saw the handwriting on the wall and knew, well, if I'm joining the army and the army's losing, I will lose and I will die. Therefore, I will hide out. And so God sends an angel with a message for Gideon. Now, God sends the angel of the Lord. Whenever you see the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, we believe this was a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ himself. We don't know that for sure. But you can see how people react to the angel of the Lord, and they worship that angel as if this is God. And so we think it's probably Jesus Christ, not so sure. But understand that angels are not fat little babies with wings or sissy Victorian women, that angels looked like men and just like an average guy. So this angel appears, shows up in the wine press where Gideon is hiding out, and Judges chapter 6, verse 12 begins the story. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him, that is to Gideon, and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." Now Gideon hears this and he's thinking, who, me? I mean, Gideon hasn't done anything valiant or brave. He's not a brave warrior in battle. He is a chicken hiding out. So this guy shows up saying, "Oh, mighty man of valor." And Gideon is like looking over his shoulder. He's like, "Well, me talking to me?" And so his response is not to salute, "Yes, here I am. I am the mighty man of valor." Gideon replies with a complaint. "All right, yeah. If God is really for us, then why are we getting beat up by the Midianites every day? And where are all these miracles we hear about? God helping our forefathers. God is not for us. God has forsaken us." And the angel is not fazed by this complaint. The angel says, "Gideon, you, in all of your strength and might, you go and save Israel." And again, Gideon doesn't understand. He responds in verse 15, saying, "Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh." Manasseh was his tribe. "And I am the least in my father's house." Gideon was not a warrior. Gideon was a nobody. He was an unknown man. He was the runt of the litter. He was the weakest of all of his brothers in the weakest tribe in all of Israel. And so he's just thinking, I'm not some macho man to lead troops in battle. How in the world am I supposed to do this? And so it takes some convincing. Gideon has to get some things clear. It takes some convincing, but finally Gideon believes this is a messenger sent by God. He believes that God has called him to save Israel. And so he goes that night, the very night that the angel appears to him, and he destroys the altar to Baal and the Asherah pole that was in his dad's front yard. He was living in his father's home, and he went at night. Now, understand, he went at night because he was afraid to do it in the middle of the day. Again, this is a time that the people of Israel were worshiping idols, and so everyone had an altar and an Asherah pole so they could worship these pagan gods, and Gideon didn't want to get in a fight, right? He took the coward way out. Instead of taking a big hammer in the middle of the day and letting everyone see, he sneaks in at night, and he destroys his dad's pagan altar and Asherah pole. And so the next morning, people wake up and said, "Who did this?" And apparently, Gideon's dad buys into Gideon's leadership. And Gideon is hiding behind his dad, and dad has to take and face the accusations from all the people. But the people, they don't attack Gideon. Instead, Gideon surges to a position of leadership where he finds himself leading an army of thousands and thousands of men. And they're gathered together, and Gideon is seeking God to determine, how are we going to go forward and defeat the Midianites and continue to take possession of this land? And God shows up and tells Gideon, "Gideon, you got too many troops, right? We need to pare this thing down a little bit." God says, "Go and tell the guys who are scared that they can go home if they want." And I'm sure Gideon's thinking, "Oh, I'm one of those guys. I'm not so sure about this whole battle thing." But Gideon obeys, and he stands before the people, and he says, "If you're scared, God says you get to go home. You don't have to fight this battle." And 22,000 troops leave, and there's only 10,000 troops remaining. Again, I don't know a whole much about military strategy, but I think more is more. And if you're going to go into hand-to-hand combat, you want more troops than your enemy. But God says, "Tell the scaredy cats to go home." And so they do. So now Gideon has 10,000. He's trying to figure out, how am I going to defend Israel against the Midianites with only 10,000? And God says, "Well, you know what, Gideon? Your army is still too big. You need to pare it down a little bit more. Here's what I want you to do, Gideon. I want you to take all your men to the river. And the guys that get down on their hands and knees, and they put their face in the river, and they drink it up there like a dog, lapping it with their tongue, you send those guys home. But the guys who will kneel down and stick their hand in the river and cup the water with their hand and pull it up to their mouth, those are the guys you want to take to battle." Gideon says, "All right." So he takes the guys to the river and watches. And of the 10,000, only 300 put their hand in the water, pulling the water up to their mouths. The other 9,700, they're just on all fours like a bunch of dogs, putting their face in the river. And so Gideon sends them on. Now Gideon has 300 men. He went from over 30,000 now to 300. With 300 men, this so-called mighty man of valor is to lead Israel against the Midianites. And Gideon develops a plan. Gideon tells his troops, he says, "Here's what we're going to do, boys. Every one of you, you need to get a trumpet, get a clay pot, and get a torch. This is what we'll do. We will go at night, and we'll surround the camp of the Midianites, and we'll light our torches, but we'll cover it with that pot so we can sneak in at night and they won't even see us. And while they're all comfy in their beds, Gideon said, I'll blow a trumpet. And when I do, every one of you, you blow a trumpet. Break the pot, revealing your light, and we'll all shout for the Lord and for Gideon." And the men surprisingly go along with it and say, "All right, where's that trumpet? I'm going to go get a trumpet. I'm going to do this." Now, I wonder, though, if there were a few men thinking, "All right, Gideon, but then what?" Because he doesn't say what's going to happen next. I think you're a army guy. You're a soldier ready for battle, and you're armed with a torch and a trumpet. Surely there were some of those warriors going, "Okay, we blow the trumpet, we do the torch thing, and we shout, but then what? Are we supposed to just whack the Midianites in the head with our trumpets? You know, like we're in an episode of the Three Stooges? What, we're going to like pull their hair and poke them in the eye? I mean, what are we going to do?" We don't ever find out. We're never told the rest of the plan. So the guys, even with their questions and hesitation, they follow Gideon. And so they go at night. after the many nights had a full meal over an open fire, and they were all snugly warm in their tents, the blankets pulled up tight. Gideon and his men, they take their trumpets, they light their torches, they cover that torch with a pot, and they sneak in at night and they surround the entire camp. And when they get set, Gideon blows his trumpet, and then everyone blows a trumpet, and they break that clay pot, revealing the torches. And when the guys, when the Midianites in their tents hear it, man, it awakens them quick. Because they were all settled down for the night. They were all comfortable, and they hear the sound of the trumpet, and they knew that it would be captains in the army that would carry a trumpet in order to direct a single platoon. And hearing hundreds and hundreds of trumpets made them think there must be hundreds and hundreds of captains. This must mean there's thousands and thousands of troops. And they get all confused. And they just rush out of their tents with their swords. And they see the lights and they hear the noise and the shouting. And they begin just to turn their swords on each other. And for those that don't get slaughtered, they run for the hills. And Gideon and his men, they walk into the camp, winning the battle, winning the day, trumpet in hand. I can imagine old Gideon taking a bite out of his cigar, lighting it up, sitting up against a rock there at night saying, I love it when a plan comes together. Now, Gideon is held up as a hero of faith all the way into the New Testament. In Hebrews chapter 11, when it talks about those that are heroes of faith, we see Gideon's name. But I would caution you before you go too quick and misunderstanding the story of Gideon. Because the story of Gideon is not the story of how God turns a zero into a hero. Because Gideon, his life doesn't end very well. Yes, he wins the day with the trumpets and the torches. That was a good plan. That worked out. He won that battle. But he didn't end so well. That military victory caused within him a lust for blood and violence to surge. So that later on in his life, they went into a city, asked for food. They were given no food. They went and won their battle. They came back and killed everybody in the city because they wouldn't feed them. Then later, Gideon constructs an ephod, which is it's a robe that priests would wear. And he gathered a lot of gold to make this thing. And it just became a point of fixation for all of Israel that many of them began to worship it as an idol. And then we see after Gideon's death, the people of Israel, they run right back into idol worship. So the story of Gideon is not the story of God turning zeros into heroes. The story of Gideon is how God can rescue by stripping a man down to virtually nothing. And so in the story of Gideon, what we are seeing is a foreshadowing of the story of Jesus himself, who won the battle over the enemies of sin and the Satan and death by being stripped down to virtually nothing. In the New Testament, Philippians chapter 2 says this about Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Jesus made himself nothing. What that means is that Jesus stripped himself of all of his power and authority as God in order to live as a man, as a real human being. He never ceased to be God, but he took his utility belt of God powers off and laid it aside, being stripped of all his power, all his authority as God to live as a human being, to live and to suffer and to eventually become king and savior, not by slaying his enemies with the sword, but by being slain. Philippians 2 tells us the rest of the story. In verse 8, and being found in human form, he, Jesus, humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has exalted him, highly exalted him, and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. See, Jesus is very similar to Gideon. Jesus becomes a warlord, sort of. It's warlord minus the war. For Jesus would not win the battle by the power of the sword, but by the power of the Spirit. And so Jesus is like Gideon. He's not a warlord, but he becomes the Lord. He becomes the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords. And so in the story of Gideon, what we see really is the story of Jesus. And now Jesus today is blowing his trumpet. He is announcing that God is here, that the kingdom is here, and that there is another way. And we can respond even today to his call by saying yes. By saying, you got this crazy plan, Jesus, but we trust you because we believe that you're God, because we believe that you know the way, and we want to follow you. And the way we can respond today is by coming to meet with Jesus at his table in holy communion. See, coming to the table of Jesus is responding to his call. And what we're serving today is a meal, but it's a stripped-down meal. It's just a little bread and just a little bit of liquid in the cup. It's a stripped-down meal, but it will connect you to Jesus, who was stripped down of all of his power and authority. And in humility and in obedience, lived the life that we should have lived, and then died the death we should have died, that by through his resurrection, we could experience forgiveness and healing and new life. And you can respond this morning. You can say, yes, Jesus, I want to follow you and I want to go your way. I want to respond to your call and come to your table. Let's stand up together. Let's prepare ourselves to meet with Jesus at his table. I'll lead you in a prayer of confession. This is what you do in your response in communion. And so I'll lead you in a prayer of confession, confessing that Jesus truly is Lord, that he is King, and that he is Savior of the entire world. And I'll also lead you in a prayer of confession of sin, where we rightly acknowledge that, yeah, we're sinful, broken people still in need of a Savior. And then after our prayer, our table servers will first be served. Then once they get to the tables, then our ushers will release you row by row to come and to meet with Jesus at his table. Maybe you've done this for the first time, or maybe you've done this for the 1,000th time. But let it be a special moment of communion with you, where you're saying, yes, Jesus, I'm going to follow you. Or yes, Jesus, I'm renewing myself to be your follower as I meet with you at the table. Let's pray together.